This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. After the election and as Brexit begins to dominate Parliament, it matters where Labour stands on Europe. But where exactly is that? This afternoon, Jeremy Corbyn met with the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, who, earlier in the week, had said this.
We have published 9 EU position papers so far on the different issues. And the EU positions are clear. We now need to know the UK's position on each of these issues in order to make progress. We cannot remain idle as the clock is ticking.
Europe is ready, says Monsieur Barnier. But when Britain will be, and what for, could now depend, despite its being in opposition, on the Labour Party. With Brexit about to dominate a hung parliament, Labour's 262 MPs will help to shape the outcome. What do they believe, and what will determine how they act? Step inside the briefing room and find out where Labour stands on Brexit. To understand Labour's European present, we need to understand its European past. Stephen Fielding is a professor of political history at the University of Nottingham. He gave me this historical briefing starting in the 1960s.
So in the early 1960s, Hugh Gaitskell stood against going in to the then common market because he didn't believe that it secured Britain's post-imperial interest with the Commonwealth.
Here's Hugh Gaitskell, leader of the Labour Party.
For we are not just a part of Europe, at least not yet. We have a different history. We have ties and links which run across the whole world. If this is the idea, the end of Britain as an independent nation state, I make no apology for repeating it, the end of 1,000 years of history. You may say, all right, let it end. But my goodness, it's a decision that needs a little care and thought.
Those positions slightly changed after Gaitskell's death, and Harold Wilson became Prime Minister, and the British economy was clearly in trouble. So he started negotiations twice with the common market.
Just what happened at the Elysee Palace, only 4 or 5 men really know. Perhaps only 2, the Prime Minister and President de Gaulle. Everybody knew, of course, that Britain's entry into the common market would be neither agreed nor refused at the Paris meetings. Obviously, there is still a lot of hard bargaining to be done. Diplomacy in Paris doesn't go like a bull at a gate.
But on both occasions, didn't lead to entry. And by trying to enter the common market, he aroused the hostility and suspicions of many people on the left. So when Labour entered opposition and the Heath government that was elected in 1970 actually did succeed in taking Britain into the common market, the party was implacably opposed to joining the common market, exemplified by Barbara Castle's position during an Oxford Union debate on the issue.
This then is the new internationalism, a selective relationship with the rest of the world controlled and dictated by a powerful European bloc. And what kind of internationalism is it that says that henceforth this country must give priority to a Frenchman over an Indian, a German over an Australian, an Italian over a Malaysian? This isn't the language of internationalism. This isn't the language that we've been hearing in this debate tonight. It is Euro-jingoism. There's been...
So that forced Wilson to hold a referendum in 1975, once he'd become Prime Minister again, as to whether Britain should stay or should it go. By the early 1980s, the left had actually taken fuller control of the party and its policy making. And when Labour went into the 1983 election, it was formally committed to leaving the EEC. Here's Michael Foot, leader of the Labour Party.
No one can doubt that the people, those of us who opposed entry to the market, that it's our prophecies that have proved justified and not those who got us in.
After 1983, the party changed its attitude towards Europe. The situation by the time of the 1987 and 1992 general elections was that the British Labour movement, the trade unions, were under the Thatcherite cosh, and they saw the introduction of the social chapter through what would become the EU as a way of getting back rights that they had lost thanks to the Conservative government. So the party's position had fundamentally changed to being extremely positive about the EU. By 1997, the Labour Party became, apparently, the party of Europe. She came from Greece, she had a
thirst for knowledge. It is our destiny to lead in Europe. And Europe needs us. For we have a vision of Europe. We want a people's Europe.
Blair's own vision of the EU and Britain's place within it was, however, slightly different to that of many of his own party members. He was more in favour of the EU being the kind of capitalist club that many of his own party members on the left, including, of course, Jeremy Corbyn, had long feared that it actually was. Jeremy Corbyn's position is that of the classic Labour left. He's always had, ever since becoming a member of the party in the 1970s, severe misgivings about the organisation, seeing it as an organisation for capitalism, not favourable to the kind of socialism that he wants to build.
On a scale of 1 to 10, one is couldn't really care less about the EU and 10 is I'm jumping on the couch like Tom Cruise on Oprah, how passionate are you about staying in the EU?
Oh, I'd put myself in the upper half of the 5 to 10, so we're looking at 7, 7.5.
Ooh, not quite.
Maybe 7.
That was Jeremy Corbyn appearing on The Last Leg on Channel 4. But that was an eon ago, back in the spring of 2016. What's happened in Labour since the referendum vote to leave the European Union? BBC political correspondent Chris Mason has been following it all microscopically.
So, where do Labour stand? Well, since the referendum, it hasn't always been abundantly clear. On the day after the vote, Jeremy Corbyn set out what his priority was.
The British people have made the decision. We must respect that result, and Article 50 has to be invoked now so that we negotiate an exit from the European Union.
He later said he hadn't quite meant that. Enter next the question of whether the UK should stay in the customs union. This is the bit of the EU which clubs together to agree to apply the same tariffs to goods from outside the union. This was Emily Thornberry, the shadow foreign secretary, standing in for Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Question Time in December.
We all know that it would be a disaster for British business if we do not remain part of the customs union.
But from the apparently definitive to the decidedly equivocal. Here was the shadow Brexit Secretary Sir Keir Starmer last month.
So far as the customs union is concerned, the question whether it's better to be in or out can only be determined further down the line, because you need to know first, what's the deal you've done on the single market? Does it, at the end of the exercise, make more sense to stay in or stay out?
It also hasn't always been clear what the party plans to do about freedom of movement and immigration. This was Jeremy Corbyn in January.
We're not wedded to free movement to the EU as a point of principle, but I don't want to be misinterpreted, nor do we rule it out. We cannot afford to lose full access to European markets on which so many British businesses and jobs depend. Changes to the way migration rules operate from the EU will obviously be part of the negotiations.
Then there's the question of what to do about the single market. That's the bit of the EU which eliminates tariffs, quotas or taxes on trade and includes the free movement of goods, services, capital and people. It also means different rules on packaging, safety and standards and many other things are abolished, and the same rules and regulations apply across the area. This was the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell speaking on Peston on Sunday on ITV last month.
Just to be clear on this, because I think people, you know, I think this is very important to people, you would support the Prime Minister if it remains, if Theresa May remains Prime Minister during these talks, you would support her in her determination to get us out of the European single market.
Well, let's be clear. We're respecting the decision of the referendum. We are Democrats. We're respecting the decision.
Yes, but the decision was about leaving the EU. It wasn't about leaving the single market.
I think people will interpret membership of the single market as not respecting that referendum.
Labour remains wedded to the idea of leaving the single market.
It's access to the single market on a tariff-free
basis.
Sure,
I understand it.
But the day after, the Shadow International Trade Secretary, Barry Gardiner, had other ideas when he was asked about this by Sarah Montagu on the Today programme.
What we said is that we need those benefits, and whether they're achieved through reformed membership of the single market and the customs union or through a new bespoke trading arrangement is actually secondary to achieving the benefits. That's what we stated in our manifesto. So we haven't...
You want to end up with the same benefits, but you're definitely leaving.
What we've said is it's an open question as to what we can get.
Confused? Me too. Well, let's look at Labour's manifesto on this. I've got a copy here. It says they want to retain the benefits of the single market and the customs union, and that freedom of movement will end when we leave the European Union. That's what we can discern of Labour's position. How far, though, is it feasible? Catherine Barnard is Professor of European Union Law at Cambridge, and she's in the briefing room. Catherine Barnard, before we progress, what actually is the single market, and what do we get out of being in it?
So, the single market comprises four freedoms, that is, the free movement of goods, the free movement of services, the free movement of people, and the free movement of capital. And what it means is, in practice, it's as easy to sell my goods between London and Rome as it is between London and Edinburgh.
Now, people also often say that they want to retain access to the single market. What does that mean?
Well, it's a rather odd term, actually, because, in fact, every country in the world has access to the single market because, providing they pay the tariffs, if tariffs are due on the product, once they've paid the tariffs, they can go into the EU and then they can sell their goods just in the same way as any EU goods can be sold. But crucially, Chinese goods, American goods, which are being sold on the EU market, must comply with EU regulatory standards.
So access to the single market doesn't really mean anything. It just means what everybody has.
What everybody has, it's nothing special at all. What is crucial, and the difference lies in between the terminology of access, on the one hand, which everyone has, and membership, on the other. And at the moment, we have membership of the single market, which means that there are no tariffs on our goods moving between EU countries, that the rules that UK goods have got to comply with, or UK services have got to comply with, are laid down in EU rules over which the UK has some say in setting the standards.
Now, if Labour wants, as it says, to retain the benefits of the single market, so not just access, but effectively what comes from being a member of the single market, and they also want to end free movement of people, is that actually legally and technically feasible?
No, not really. And that's the point that Michel Barnier, the principal EU negotiator, made.
Fourth, the single market and its four freedoms are indivisible. Cherry picking is not an option.
Now, we've also heard Labour say that it wants to retain the benefits of the customs union. What's the customs union?
So the single market is primarily about the movement of goods and about people. And it's about particularly removing so-called non-tariff barriers. And non-tariff barriers is a jargon for regulatory standards. So if I want to sell my gin in France, the French cannot throw their rule book at me to say that the gin has got to have a certain minimum alcohol content. Customs union, on the other hand, is about tariffs. And tariffs vary depending on the nature of the product. They are generally about 2 or 3%, but for some products, like agricultural products, they're as high as 40 or 50%. And in the customs union, there are no tariffs. But from a Leave point of view, the downside of being in the customs union is that we cannot have free trade deals with countries like India or China. In the customs union, only the EU can negotiate trade deals.
Now, looking at the Labour Party position in the round, as you've heard it laid out and seen in the manifesto, what arrangement can you see that would come close to what it is that they want?
The closest is the European Economic Area. It's known as Doing a Norway for short. Now, what Norway has is the membership of the single market in the sense that they enjoy the four freedoms I mentioned. But what they don't have is any input into the making of the rules which regulate the single market. So essentially Norway is a rule taker rather than a rule maker. Norway is also not in the customs union, which means that there is a hard border between Norway and Sweden, for example.
So Norway can negotiate these other trade deals.
Indeed, it can.
And so on. Also is inside the single market.
It's inside the single market.
But it must also accept freedom of movement of peoples.
And there is a bit of wriggle room. Even under the current arrangements, while we're still in the EU, there are two ways of restricting free movement of workers. First, there's a general restriction where there are public policy or public security concerns. It must be said that's very tightly defined and so has not been much used to limit migration. But there's another possibility, which is that you can only stay in the UK if you've got a job, if you're a worker, or you're self-employed, or you've got sufficient resources to look after yourself or a student. In respect of those who are workers, it does cover people who are looking for work, but they normally only have 3 months to look for work. And if at the end of that period they haven't got a reasonable prospect of having a job, they can be asked to leave. Now, this is where the UK has not been very proactive. Other states have been much more proactive.
So actually, even currently, we could enforce a much stricter staying rule.
Absolutely.
Than there is.
But part of our problem is we don't actually know who's here because we don't have any form of identity cards. We don't have any form of border checks to see who's coming and going. But you might say this would be getting into the weeds of detail, which Labour manifestos don't do. But there is some wriggle room already, even within the framework of the existing law. If they're inclined to take it.
Professor Catherine Barnard. Labour's demands may be unclear, may not even be achievable. But they do say they will leave the European Union. However, in a previous edition of The Briefing Room, looking at the results of the snap election, polling expert John Curtis told us this.
We certainly know that the way in which people voted was related to how they voted in the EU referendum. And you can see that, for the most part, the Labour Party gained votes since 2015 amongst those who voted Remain, whereas the Conservatives in particular lost ground amongst that group.
John Curtis. So how might that strong but not unanimous Labour voter preference for Remain influence the party's developing position on Brexit? Still with me is Stephen Fielding, Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham, and we're joined by Deborah Mattinson, now of the polling company Britain Thinks and a former advisor to Gordon Brown. Deborah Mattinson, you heard what I did. There's a significant ambiguity about Labour, to say the least. Now, has this been a problem for Labour so far?
I don't think it's been a problem for Labour so far. I think it's actually potentially been a benefit for Labour if we think about the election that we've just had, where the people that voted Labour were a slightly higgledy-piggledy coalition of different sorts of voters. As John Curtis has just said, there was clear correlation between Remain voters and Labour voting. But Labour also didn't do as badly as many predicted in more Brexity leave areas as well. The UKIP vote tended to go to the Tories, but actually Labour managed to hold on to some of those seats. Now, my feeling is that Jeremy Corbyn's somewhat equivocal position probably helped. People were able to kind of interpret it kind of however they wanted.
Stephen Fielding, do you think Labour even needs to clarify its stance? It's the kind of view, if you remember the kind of traditional view, you're in opposition and it's your job to hold the kind of government's feet to the fire. And therefore, you can take a calculation based on your party advantage rather than on the issue itself.
Absolutely not. It doesn't need to reveal its hand at any point until the vote comes about the exit deal that may come within the next 2 years. So all Labour needs to do is to ask awkward questions, to kind of expose the Conservatives' own confusions on it and hopefully take advantage of divisions and just sit back and watch.
OK. I mean, Labour voters have been called an uncomfortable coalition. We've talked about it a little already. We have these what are called new Labour voters. In other words, that significant kind of Labour
surge. New voters, actually, not just new Labour.
Well, exactly. How do you think, Deborah Mattinson, that those voters who voted in greater numbers affect Labour's stance on this?
Well, some of those new voters and the voters that Labour did particularly well with, we know, are passionate Remainers. So they tend to be younger, they tend to be well-educated, they tend to be in urban conurbations, particularly London, which is essentially a Remain city. And I think that they will be looking for more leadership. And, you know, if we look back, forget the election campaign for a moment, which obviously Corbyn did very well. He's a great campaigner. But before that, he was under a lot of criticism for not being a very strong leader of the opposition, not actually opposing very strongly. And I think that people will be looking for more.
But doesn't a counter-argument to that go, well, whatever they were, whatever they were, Remainers or not, they signed up for a manifesto that was clearly about leaving. And this figure is often cited, you know, 81% of the British population voted for parties that wanted out and so on. The suggestion being that they would somehow be easily mollified by quite a negative position by Labour on remaining.
Well, I don't know, again, if you look to the fairly recent past, the most uncomfortable moment so far in Jeremy Corbyn's leadership was immediately after the EU referendum, where people felt very let down by his, rather kind of lacklustre performance. And we heard it earlier when, you know, he was asked that question, what do you give it out of 10? And he came up with, what did he say, 7 or 7.5? No, 7. And I think that some of the young people who were very passionate Remainers were despairing at that point. I think they really will be looking for him to come out with something that is a bit more, a bit stronger.
Deborah, sticking with the voters for a moment, I'm Jeremy Corbyn, let's imagine. You advised Gordon Brown on strategy, you can advise me now. What should I do to maintain an appeal to the, and actually extend an appeal to the disparate voter groups, Remainers, Leavers and so on?
Well, I think what he needs to do is to spell out his own position. And I think he needs to find and own his own vocabulary as well. I mean, at the moment, what's being bandied around it's an opportunity and it misses the mark with the public. So most people don't know, for instance, what the customs union is. They barely know what the single market is, actually. So there's a real opportunity there to define it. I know they do now, obviously, now they've listened to this programme, but generally they don't. I think another interesting area is the vocabulary that everybody's using of hard and soft Brexit. I just used it myself. But actually, what we know from the work that we've been doing at Britain Thinks is people misunderstand that. They think hard Brexit means tough negotiation and soft Brexit, well, who wants to be soft anything, actually? So I think there's a real opportunity to do some redefining.
Let's move it on from the voters for a moment, Stephen Fielding, and look actually at the currents amongst Labour MPs and activists. There's a huge division in the party. You have Chuka Umunna starting that kind of cross-party group to represent the Remain voice. And then on the other hand, as we've heard, we also have John McDonnell saying not even in the single market and so on, and being very distinct from that. Does that represent an actual and proper division within the parliamentary Labour Party?
I think it does within the parliamentary Labour Party. I mean, only 49 Labour MPs voted for Chuka Umunna's amendment to the Queen's Speech. But I think that was partly because Labour just had that very good campaign under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, and they didn't want to come out and look like they were dividing the party and coming out against him. How long that will last, I don't know.
So you say, sorry to interrupt you, so you think there are more Labour MPs who would over time be willing to subscribe to that position?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The closer we get to the final decision and the more that we know about... I mean, partly people are waiting to see how the economy is going to react. And it's the economic argument which I think is going to drive this. And also the problem for... I mean, Deborah says Jeremy Corbyn should define his position. His position is bizarre in terms of the Labour Party and the wider electorate, and particularly those that Labour has attracted and those that Labour wants to hold on to. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has got ideological objections to the single market, in particular its possible effect on nationalisation. He's got very committed to basically free movement, really. So his position is very, very strange. And so he's been able to finesse that. And because he's Jeremy Corbyn, this is something that may be a very time-bound thing, because he is Jeremy Corbyn, and Jeremy Corbyn has got this great persona at the moment, and there are people in the Labour Party who will support him come hell or high water, even though they may disagree with some of the things he does. He's getting away with that. But as Deborah suggests, this is something that maybe he can't... It's not sustainable. At some point, decisions are going to have to be made. I mean, he's got, even before the election, for example, 68% of Labour's own members wanted to have a second referendum at the end of the Brexit process. That's not Labour Party policy. So there are some. So it's not just in the parliamentary party, but amongst his own supporters, the activists out in the country he's got issues with.
So, Deborah Mattison, are we saying, really, that Labour is actually a Remain party with Remain voters trying to negotiate a process that it actually doesn't believe in?
Yes, I mean, I think that both Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, as Stephen's just suggested, are somewhat at odds not only with the party, but with the voters that supported them. They're both, I think, natural Eurosceptics. They're kind of quite old-fashioned, you know, almost like Barbara Castle, as we heard in the earlier clip, the boss's common market. That's where they're at, and they're at odds with everybody else.
And they're managing this business of being odds. So a final thought, the hung parliament, which we didn't expect, or people didn't expect, drastically changes Labour's role in the Brexit negotiation.
Just makes them no more powerful. Real power.
Yeah, they have real power. So they are going to have to make some decisions that might alienate some voters. So, OK, your prediction, Deborah, if they have to do that, which side are they going to come down on? I'll come to you in a minute, Stephen Fielding.
Well, this is very interesting, because actually, as Stephen just said, they have this very odd position because they're also in favour of freedom of movement. So, curiously, the current position for the leadership kind of alienates everybody. So clarifying that and moving in one direction or the other would be better. But as I've said earlier, my feeling is the best place to be would be to be, you know, passionately defending the idea of a single market, with all that means, whilst simultaneously reaching out and understanding why people voted Leave.
Stephen Fielding.
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn would be happy for Britain to be outside the single market and to have some kind of controls over immigration, but not ones that really will change the number of people coming into the country. That's what he wants. I don't know that the rest of the party would allow him to do that.
I'm going to interpret this very quickly for both of you. Deborah, I think you're saying that they'll have to come down for the Norway option, and you, Stephen, are not so sure.
No.
I think that's probably fair enough.
That's all from The Briefing Room this week. My producers were Phoebe Keane and Beth Sagar-Fenton. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.